The Radio Effect Players presents A Christmas Carol by Sir Charles Dickens's Hello and welcome back to stave 3 of Christmas Carol by Sir Charles Dickens's Cecil, do you have anything to say?
Do you want me to be taking over the role of the narrator, Paul?
No.
Oh, please, I've so little to read in this.
We all pick parts from the hat, and I'm sorry, but you got the part you got, I got the part I got. And if I'm taking centre stage and being the proudest little gentleman, then I'm afraid that's two bads for everybody. Oof. Looking grumpy at me, ladies and gentlemen, just folded his arms, sat back on his director's style chair. You're not a director, Cecil.
Never said I was.
So, let's begin with, or continue rather, stave I.
Stave 3.
Ah, see, Roman numerals. Stave 3, the second of the three spirits. The second of my three spirits is usually vodka. Start off with whiskey, move on to vodka, and then when I'm very drunk and can tolerate it, I go on to the gin. Mum's gin, isn't it, Mum?
What? Drinking my gin? Yeah.
Shouldn't have admitted that, probably. Anyway, let's crack on, because it's taking forever. Still snowing. The coffee morning's still shut today. And snow is sliding down the chimney. Not the chimney, the roof.
Get on with it!
Temper, temper, Cecil. Here we go. Scratch the boobledge and la 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 la. Awaking in the middle of a prestigiously tough snore and sitting up in bed with his thoughts, trying to get his thoughts together.
Stop picking your nose while you're reading.
Sorry, I just got bogies. Got the heating on, it's dried off my nose. Sorry. Scrooge had no occasion to be told that the bell was again on the strike of one. He felt that he was restored to consciousness right in the nick of time for the especial purpose, and it does say for the especial purpose, of holding a conference with a second messenger dispatched to him through Jacob Marley's intervention. But finding that he turned uncomfortably cold when he began to wonder which of these curtains this new spectre would draw back, he put them, every one, aside with his own hands, and laying down again, established a sharp look round, all round the bed, for he wished to challenge the spirit on the moment of its appearance, and did not wish to be taken by surprise, and made nervous. Gentlemen of free and easy sort who plume themselves on being acquainted with a move or two and being usually equal to the time of day express a wide range of their capacity for adventure by observing that they are good for anything from pitch and toss to manslaughter. Between which opposites extreme, no doubt, there lies a tolerable wide and comprehensive range of subjects. Oh, God, he's off on one again. Without venturing for Scrooge quite as harshly as this, I don't mind calling on you to believe that he was ready for a good broad field of strange appearances, and that nothing between a bear and a rhinoceros would have astonished him very much. Now being prepared for almost anything, he was not by any means prepared for nothing, and consequently, when the bell struck one and no shape appeared, he was taken with a violent fit of trembling. 5 minutes. 10 minutes. A quarter of an hour went by. Yet nothing came. All of this time he lay upon his bed, the very core and centre of a blaze of ruddy light, which streamed upon it when the clock proclaimed the hour, and which, being only light, was more than alarming than a dozen ghosts. As he was powerless to make out what it meant, or would be, and was sometimes apprehensive that he might be at that... Oh, my goodness. It's very dense text here we're looking at. I should have zoomed in a bit. And was sometimes apprehensive that it might be at the very moment of an interesting case of spontaneous combustion without having the consolation of knowing it. At last, however, he began to think, as you or I would have thought at first, for it's always been... God. For it's always been the person not in the predicament who knows what ought to have been done and would unquestionably have gone to... oh, my God. Getting lightheaded. There's so much dense text. It's all moving about and changing places. Like some kind of word-based cat struggling to chase a laser. Sorry about that. At last... sorry, I'm going back to the text now. Everyone's just staring at me. Sorry, right, here we go. At last, I say, to begin, I think... Tell you what, let's skip that, because it's nonsense. The source and the secret of this ghostly light might be in the adjoining room, Scrooge thought, from whence, on further tracing it, the light seemed to shine. This idea taking full possession of his mind, he got up softly and shuffled in his slippers to the door. The moment Scrooge's hand was on the lock, a strange voice called him by name and bade him enter. Scrooge obeyed. It was his own room. There was no bloody doubt about that. But it had undergone a surprise and transformation. The walls and the ceiling were hung with living green, that it looked like a perfect grove, from every part of which the light gleaming bright gleaming berries glistened inside. The crisp leaves of holly and mistletoe and ivy reflected back the light, as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there. Such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney, that as dull petrification of a hearth I'd never known in Scrooge's time, or Marley's for that matter, or for any and many winter seasons gone. Heaped upon the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, suckling pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, hot lead chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, sorry about that. Juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense twelfth cakes, and seething bowls of punch. Then it made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. An easy state upon this couch, there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch, in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, whoever that is, and held it up, high up, to shed light on Scrooge, and as he came peeping round the door,
"Oh, come in," exclaimed the ghost. "Come in and know me better, man.
Scrooge entered timidly and hung... Sorry about that. And hung his head before the spirit. He was not the dogged Scrooge had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them.
"I'm the ghost of Christmas present,"
said the spirit.
"Look upon me."
Scrooge reverently did so. It was clothed in one simple green robe, or mantle, broidered with white fur. This garment hung so loosely on the figure that its capacious breast was bare, as if disdaining to be wound or concealed by any artifact. Oh, what have I done? Oh, by any artifact. Sorry, I right-clicked on the screen. It all went wrong. Its feet were observable beneath the ample folds of the garment. They were also bare, and on its head it wore no other cover than a holly wreath, set here and there with shining icicles. Its brown curls were long and free, free as its genial face. Its sparkling eyes, its open hand, its cheery voice, its unconstrained demeanour, its joyful air, girded around its middle, it was an antique scabbard, but no sword was in it, and the ancient sheath was eaten up with rust.
Ooh, you have never seen the likes of me before,
exclaimed the spirit.
No, never,
Scrooge made answer to it.
Have you never walked forth with the younger members of my family? Meaning my elder brothers born in these later years?
Pursued the phantom.
I don't think I have,
said Scrooge.
I'm afraid I have not. Have your many brothers spurt? Ooh, more than 1,800,
said the ghost.
A tremendous family to provide for,
thought Scrooge. The ghost of Christmas present rose.
Spurt,
said Scrooge submissively.
Please conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learnt a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it. Ooh, do you know? You note touch my robe. Ooh.
Scrooge did as he was told, and he held it fast.
Holly, a mistletoe, red berries, ivy, turkey, geese, game, poultry, brawn, mean, pigs, sausages, oysters, pies, puddings, fruits and punch, all vanished instantly.
So did the room, the fire, the ruddy glow, the hour of night, and they stood there in the city streets of Christmas morn, where, for the weather was severe, the people made a rough but brisk and not unpleasant kind of music, in scraping the snow from the pavement in front of their dwellings. From the top of their houses, whence it was a mad delight for the boys to see coming plumping down the road below and splitting into artificial little snowstorms. Oh, here we go. The house fronts looked black enough, and the windows blacker, contrasting with the smooth white sheet of snow upon the roofs and with the dirty snow upon the ground, which last deposit had been ploughed up in deep furrows by the heavy wheels of carts and wagons, furrows that crossed and recrossed each other hundreds of times, where the great streets branched off and made their intricate channels, hard to trace in the thick yellow and mud of the icy water. The sky was gloomy, and the shortest streets were choked up with a dingy mist, half thawed, half frozen, whose heavier particles descended in a showery snow of sooty atoms, as if the chimneys in Great Britain had, by one constant, caught fire and were blazing away to their dear heart's content. There was nothing very cheerful in the climate or the town, and yet there was an air of cheerfulness abroad, with the clearest summer air and brightest summer sun might have endeavoured to diffuse in vain. Why? Well, for the people who were shovelling away on their housetops were jovial and full of glee because they were old and old cockney geezers and they were full of glee, calling out to one another from the parapets and now and then exchanging a fastidious snowball. Better natured missile far by than any wordly jest. Wordy jest? What? Laughing heartily if it went right and not less heartily if it went wrong. The poulterer's shops were still half open, and the were radiant in their glory. There were great round pot-bellied baskets of chestnuts, shaped like the waistcoats of jolly old men, lolling in the doors and tumbling out in the streets in their apoplectic ebullience. There were ruddy brown-faced broad-girthed Spanish onions, shining in the fatness of their growth like Spanish friars, and winking from their shelves in wanton slyness, at the girls as they went by. Oof. You ever been winked at by an onion? Ugh. I've lost my place. There were pears and apples clustered high in blooming pyramids. There were bunches of grapes, made in the shopkeeper's benevolence to dangle from the... There were bunches of grapes, made in the shopkeeper's benevolence to dangle from conspicuous hooks. Conspicuous hooks? Must be conspicuous, do you reckon, Cecil?
I have no idea.
That people's mouths might water gratis as they passed. There were piles of filberts. Oh, were there? And these filberts were mossy and brown, recalling in their fragrance ancient walks amongst the woods and pleasant shufflings ankle deep through withered leaves. And do you know this? There were Norfolk biffins as well, squat and swarthy, setting off the yellowness of the oranges and lemons, and in the great compactness of their journey, juicy passions, urgently entreating and beseeching to be carried home in paper bags and eaten after dinner. The very gold and silver fish set forth amongst the choice fruits. Though members of a dull and stagnant blooded race appeared to know that there was something going on, and to a fish, went gasping around and round in their little world in slowness and passionless excitement. I don't know what's going on, if I'm honest with you. Those words were just a blower. And the grocers? Oh, the grocers. Nearly closed, perhaps with two shutters down, or one. But through those gaps, such glimpses. Well, it was not alone in the scale of decadence on the counter that made merry sounds. Or that the twine and rolling parted company shuttered so briskly that the canisters were rattling up and down like juggling tricks. Well, I don't know what's happening. Or even that the blended scents of teas and coffees were so grateful to the nose, or even that the raisins were so plentiful and rare, the almonds so extremely white, the sticks of cinnamon, Jesus, so long and straight, the other spices so delicious, the candied fruits so caked and spotted with malt and sugar as to make the coldest onlookers feel faint and subsequently bilious. Nor was it that the figs were moist and pulpy, or that the French plums blushed in the modest tartness in their highly decorated boxes, or everything that was good to eat and in Christmas. Oh, fruit, isn't it? There's a lot of fruit, I'm guessing that. Lost my place again. But the customers were all so hurried and so eager in their hopeful promise of the day that they tumbled up against each other at the door, crashing their wicker baskets wildly, and left their purchases on the counter, and came running back to fetch them, and committed hundreds of the like mistakes, all in the best humour possible, while the grocer and his people were so frank and fresh that the polished hearts with which they fastened their aprons might have been their own, worn outside for general inspection and for Christmas drawers to peck as if they choose. Good grief, Cecil.
Yes. Should have edited some of this down, but it paints a picture. A confusing Dickensian picture.
Yeah. Back to it. Soon the steeples called good people to all, to church and to chapel, and away they came, flocking through the streets in their best clothes and with their gayest faces. And at the same time there emerged from the stores of the by streets, lanes and nameless turnings innumerable people carrying their dinners to their best baker shops. Why would they be carrying their dinners to the baker shops?
Cecil.
Because they cooked them. They didn't have ovens and microwaves yet.
All right. Fair enough. The sight of these poor revellers appeared to interest the spirit very much, for he stood with Scrooge beside him in a baker's doorway and taking off the covers as their bearers passed. What covers? I don't know. He sprinkled incense on their dinners from his torch. Seems a bit rude. Did he ask permission to do that? Anyway, it was a very uncommon kind of torch, For once or twice when there was angry words between some dinner carriers who had jostled each other, he shed a few drops of water from them, and their good humour was restored directly.
Giggle water.
For they said it was a shame to quarrel upon Christmas Day, and so it was. God love it, so it was.
In time the bells ceased, and the bakers were shut up,
and yet there was a genial shadowing forth of all the dinners. Diners? Dinner diners? Don't know what they are.
Oh, Thistle.
Oh, my God.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry about this. We're having technical problems. The monitor says it's about to turn off in 50 seconds if we don't push a button. There we go. That's unfortunate. Have we been sat here that long?
Yeah, it was 16 years, I think it feels like.
Nah.
I've lost my place now. I don't know where we are. That shit me right up. Someone. In time the bells ceased and the bakers were shut up, and yet there was a genial shadowing forth for all the diners and the progress of their cooking in the thawed blotch of a wet above each baker's oven. Where the pavement smoke as if stone were cooking it too. What? Don't understand.
It just means, Paul, that where it had been cooking, the snow had melted and it was...
They're not bothered.
No.
I'd say, getting back to me quite rapidly, please. Spirit, excuse me, I'm talking actual. Is there a particular flavour in what you sprinkle from your torch?
Asked Scrooge.
Ooh, there is my own flavour. Ooh. Would it apply to any kind of dinner on this day?
Asked Scrooge.
Ooh, to any kindly given, to a poor one most. Why to a poor one most?
Asked Scrooge.
Ooh, because they need it most. Moo. Spirit,
said Scrooge after a moment's thought.
I wonder, you of all the beings in many world abiders, should desire to cramp these people's opportunity of insistent enjoyment?
I?
Cried the spirit, confused.
Would you deprive them of their means of dining every seventh day? Often only the day which they can be said to dine at all,
said Scrooge.
Wouldn't you?
Oh, I.
Don't think it was supposed to be like that, Sexy Susan, but yep, said the spirit.
You'll seek to close these places on the seventh day,
said Scrooge.
And it comes to the same thing.
I think,
exclaimed the spirit.
Sorry, Spirit. Forgive me if I'm wrong. It has been done in your name, hasn't it? Or at least the name of your family, to shut up shop every seventh day on the Sabbath. There are some upon this earth of yours,
returned the spirit,
who lay claim to know us, and who do their deeds of passion and pride, ill will, hatred, envy, bigotry, and selfishness in our name, who are estranged to us and all our kith and kin, as if they had never lived. Remember that, and charge their doing, on themselves, not us, the spirits,
Scrooge promised that he would, and they went on, invisible, as they had been before, into the suburbs of town. It was a remarkable quality of the ghost, which Scrooge had observed at the baker's, that notwithstanding his gigantic size, he could accommodate himself into any place with ease, and that he stood beneath a low roof quite as gracefully, like a supernatural creature, as it was possible they could have done in any lofty hall. sorry, turned into Cilla Black for a second. Excuse me. And perhaps it was the pleasure the good spirit had in showing off this power of his, or else it was his own kind, generous, hearty nature, and his sympathy with all poor men, that led him straight to Scrooge's clerk. For there he went, and took Scrooge with him, obviously. Holding on to his robe, and on the threshold of the door, the spirit smiled, and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling with a sprinkling of his torch. Think of that. Bob had but 15 bob a week himself. He pocketed on Saturdays but 15 copies of his Christian name. And yet the ghost of Christmas present blessed his four-roomed house. Probably worth £250,000, at least, these days, down in London, old London town. Excuse me. Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, dressed out but poorly in twice-turned-down gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence. And she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, second of her daughters, also brave in ribbons, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes and getting the corners of his monstrous shirt collar, Bob's private property conferred upon his son and heir in honour of the day, into his mouth, rejoiced to find himself so gallantly attired and yearned to show his linens in the fashionable parks. And now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it, saliva, and known it for their own, and basking in the luxurious thoughts of searching under them. These young Cratchits danced around the table and exalted Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he, not proud, although his collars nearly choked him up, blew the fire until slow potatoes bubbling up knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled. Peeled potatoes after they've been boiled?
"Oh, whatever's got your precious father, then?"
said Mrs. Cratchit.
"And your brother, Tiny Tim, and Martha, weren't as late as last Christmas Day by half an hour."
"Here's Martha, mother,"
said the girl, appearing as she spoke.
"Here's Martha, mother,"
cried the two young Cratchits.
"Oh, there's such a goose, Martha,"
said the two small children.
"Why, bless my heart alive, my dear. How late you are,"
said Mrs. Cratchit, kissing her a dozen times and taking off her shawl and bonnet for her own officious zeal.
"We'd a deal of work to finish up, Mother, last night," replied the girl, "and had to clear it too early this morning, Mother."
"Well, never mind so long as you are now," said Mrs. Cratchit. "Sit ye down by the fire, my dear. Have a warm tea. Lord bless ye."
"No, there's Father coming,"
cried the two young Cratchits, who were once everywhere all at the same time.
"Hide, Martha, hide!"
So Martha hid herself, in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter, exclusive of the fringe, hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder.
Alas for Tiny Tim,
he bore a little crutch and had his limbs supported by an iron frame.
Where's Martha?"
cried Bob Cratchit, looking round.
She's not coming,"
said Mrs. Cratchit.
"Not coming?"
said Bob, with a sudden delectation in his high spirits.
"What?"
"Sorry," said Bob, with a sudden declension, whatever that means, in his high spirits, for he had been Tiny Tim's blood horse all the way from church, and he'd come home rampant.
"Oh, not coming on Christmas Day?"
Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, even if it were only for a joke. So she came out prematurely from behind the closed door and ran into his arms while two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off to the wash house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper.
"How did little Tiny Tim behave?"
asked Mrs. Cratchit, when she had rallied Bob to his credulity. And Bob had hugged his daughters to his heart's content.
Oh, as good as gold,
said Bob.
And better. Somehow he gets thoughtful, sitting by himself so much and thinks the strangest thing you've ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hopes people saw him in the church, because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made beggars walk and blind men see.
Bob's voice was tremulous when he told this, and trembled more when he said that Tiny Tim was growing strong and hearty. His active little crutch was heard upon the floor, and came back Tiny Tim before another word was spoken, escorted by his brother and sister to his stool before fire. And while Bob, turning his cuffs up, as if, poor fellow, they were capable of being made more shabby, compound some hot mixture into a jug with gin and lemons and stirred it round and round and round and round, and popped it on Ob to simmer. Master Peter and the two ubiquitous young Cratchits went to fetch the goose with which they soon returned in high procession. Such a bustle ensued that you might have thought the goose rarest of all the birds, a feathered phenomenon, to which a black swan was a matter of course. Now, here we go. And in truth, it was something very like it in that house. Mrs. Cratchit admit... See, now they got their goose cooked... I wonder if that's where that saying comes from. In the bakery, but in the Muppets Christmas Carol, they're cooking the goose on the fire. And yet, they were... What?
You know full well what...
Sorry, I can't keep thinking about the Muppets Christmas Carol in this and how it lines up and what they've chosen to keep in, what they've chosen to keep out.
That's enough now, please. Come on.
Sorry. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little horse saucepan.
Did you just say little horse saucepan?
I meant to say little hot saucepan, sorry. Hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigour. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Wonder what that means. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves.
See, Paul, the family chips in to do the house chores, not like you that just sits there expecting to be served all the time.
At least the dishes were set on, and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carved table, prepared to plunge into the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose around the board. And even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat off on the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried, There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there was ever such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavour, size and cheapness, were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potato, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of bone upon the dish, that they hadn't eaten it at all at last. No. Yet every one of them had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to their eyebrows. But now the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it out. Suppose it should not be done enough? Suppose it should break... Suppose it shouldn't be done enough. Suppose it should break in turning out. Suppose someone should have gotten to it over the wall of the backyard and stolen it, while they were merry with the goose. A supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horror was supposed. Hello! Hello! A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day. That was the cloth, you see. A smell like an eating house. Oh,
What's that? I'd like to go there. And a pastry cook's next door. No, that's what it says. And a pastry cook's next door to each other. Jesus. Got confused, Cecil. I was thinking about what an eating house might be. Sorry. Let's go again. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other, with a laundress next to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball, so hard and so firm. What, woof, moo? Blazing in half a quartered ignited brandy and belighted with Christmas holly stuck to the top of it. Oh, a wonderful pudding, Bob Cratchit said, except it's not in quotation marks. Oh, a wonderful pudding, Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit, since their marriage. Oh, it's not very nice, is it? Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess that she had doubts about the quantity of flour. Everyone had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flat hearsay to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. At last dinner was all done. The cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. I assume this is where they go eat a tub of celebrations, watch a Wallace and Gromit Christmas special, and get absolutely pissed. Let's find out. The compound in the jug being tested, and considered perfect. Apples and oranges were put up the table, and a shovelful of chestnuts on the fire. They cost a pretty penny. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, meaning half a circle. And Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass. What? Okay. Two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug. However, as well as golden goblets would have... Oh, I said, sorry about that, I'm getting confused. These held the hot stuff from the jug, as well as a golden goblet would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks, while the chestnuts on the fire spluttered and crackled. Then Bob proposed,
"A Merry Christmas to all, my dears. Oh, God bless us."
To which the family echoed,
"God bless us, everyone,"
said Tiny Tim last of all. He sat very close to his father's side upon his stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his, as if he loved the child. Surely he did. As if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side, and dreaded that he might be taken from him.
"Spirit,"
said Scrooge, with an interest he'd never felt before.
"Just tell me if Tiny Tim will live." "Ooh, I see a vacant seat, sad moo," replied the ghost. "In the poor chimney corner, ooh, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, ooh, the child will die. No,
said Scrooge.
"Oh, kind spirit, say he will be spared." "Did you just trumpet my emotional text, Paul?"
"Sorry about that. Shouldn't have had dinner. That salami's gone right through me."
"If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, none other of my race,"
returned the ghost,
"will find him here. Well, what then, Moo? If he's likely to die, had he better not do it and decrease the surplus population?"
Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted back by the spirit, and was overcome with penance and grief.
"Man,"
said the ghost,
"ooh, If man you be in heart, not ambulance forbear, that wicked can't until you have discovered what the surplus is, and moo where the surplus is. You will decide what men shall live. No, will you decide what men shall live? Moo, what men shall die? Moo, yes. It may be that in the sight of heaven you are more worthless, yes, and less fit to live than millions, like this poor man's moo child. Oh, to hear the inspect of... Whoa, what?
All right, sexy Susan, just take a breath, calm down, stop rubbing yourself.
Sorry.
Okay, you ready to go again?
Yes. Oh, God!
Yeah, I don't think it's supposed to be read like that.
Right, sorry. Oh, God. To hear the insect on the leaf pronouncing on the too much life among its hungry brothers in the dust.
Okay. Well, Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke and trembling cast his eyes to the ground, but he raised them speedily on hearing his own name.
Mr. Scrooge,
said Bob.
I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast.
Founder of the feast, indeed,
cried Mrs. Cratchit, reddening.
I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I'd have a good appetite for it.
My dear,
said Bubba,
the children, it's Christmas Day.
It should be Christmas Day, I'm sure,
she said,
on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows better than you, poor fellow.
Oh, my dear,
Bob was mild with his answer.
It's Christmas Day.
Nah, I'll drink to his health for your sake and the day's,
said Mrs. Cratchit.
Not for his, though. Long life to him, and a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt.
The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings, which had no heartiness. Tiny Dancer.
Hold me close, young tiny dancer.
Sorry. Tiny Trink drank. Oh dear. Tiny Tim drank it to the last of all, but he didn't care twopence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for a full 5 minutes. Eh, Sir Jeremy Cream? Eh?
What?
Think on.
I shan't do that. What?
After it had passed away, they were 10 times merrier than before, from the mere relief of Scrooge, the baleful, being done with. Bob Cratchit told them how he had a situation in his eye for Master Peter, which would bring him in, if obtained. Full 5 and 6 pence weekly. The two young Cratchits laughed tremendously at the idea of Peter being a man of business, and Peter himself looked thoughtfully at the fire, from between his massive collars, as if he were deliberating what particular investments he should favour when it came into the receipt of that bewildering income. Martha, who was a poor apprentice at a milliner's, then told them of what kind of work she had to do, and how many hours she worked at a stretch, and how she meant to lie abed tomorrow morning for a good long rest. Tomorrow being a holiday, she passed at home. I don't think that means she dies at home, does it, says Phil?
No, she just means she's at home.
Nah. Maybe she's got a snow day too. Also, she had seen a countess, and a lord some days before, and how the lord was much about as tall as Peter, at which Peter pulled up his collar so high that you couldn't have seen his head if you'd been there. All this time the chestnuts and the jug went round and round and round. By and by they had a song about a lost child travelling in the snow from Tiny Tim, who had a plaintive little voice, and sang it very well indeed. There was nothing of high mark in this, don't know what that means. They were not a handsome family, they were not well dressed, Their shoes were far from being waterproof, their clothes were scanty, and Peter might have known, and very likely did, the inside of a pawnbroker's. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. When they faded and looked happier, yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially on Tiny Tim, until last. Okay, here we go with another giant chunk of text. By this time it was getting dark and snowing pretty heavily, and as Scrooge and the spirit went along the streets, the brightness of the roaring fires in the kitchen, parlours, and all sorts of rooms was wonderful. Here, the flickering of the blaze showed preparations for a cosy dinner, with hot plates baking through and through before the fire, and deep red curtains ready to be drawn to shut out the cold and the darkness. There all the children of the houses were running out into the... Ow! Sorry. Oh, I moved my... sorry. It's all happening. Someone pushed up. Oh, God, sorry, Cecil. I got carried away. Just imagining what it's like living in Dickensian times. What do you think we'd be like?
I don't think we'd be far off living like the Cratchits, because you don't bring in enough money.
No, I think I'd be like Fezziwig and big and bulbous, wearing like a big waistcoat, round like an alderman. Is that a thing I might be? Cecil? Yeah, come on, get back to it. Sorry. But if you had judged the... Oh, no, I've missed a bit. Sorry about that. Oh, Christ. There all the children of the houses were running out into the snow to meet their married sisters, brothers, cousins, uncles, aunts, and to be the first to greet them. Here again were shadows on the window blinds of guests assembling, and there were groups of handsome girls, all hooded and but fur-booted, and all chattering at once, tripping off lightly with some near neighbour's house, where, woe upon the single man who saw them enter, artful witches. Well, they knew it, in a glow, whatever that means. But if you had judged them from the numbers of people on their way to friendly gatherings, you might have thought that no one was at home to give them welcome when they got there, instead of every house expecting company and piling up its fires, half a chimney high. Blessings on it, how the ghost exulted. How it bared the breadth of breast, and opened up its capricious palm and floated on, outpouring with a generous hand its bright and harmless mirth on everyone it reached. The very light planter who ran before, dotting the dusky streets with specks of light, and who was dressed to spend the evening somewhere, laughed out loudly as the spirit passed. The little Kend, the lamplighter, that he had any company but Christmas, don't know what that means. And now, without a word of warning from the ghost, they stood upon a bleak and deserted moor, where monstrous masses of rude stone were cast about, as though they were the burial place of giants of spooky imagery, and water spread itself wherever it listed, or would have done so, but for the frost that held it like prisoner, and nothing grew but moss and furze and coarse, rank grass. Down to the west, the setting sun had left a streak of fiery red which glared upon the desolation for an instant, like a sullen eye, maybe like Sauron from Lord of the Rings. Who knows? Sorry. A frosting lower, lower, lower yet was lost in the thick gloom of the darkest night.
"What is this place?"
asked Scrooge.
"A place where miners live, whose labour in the bowels of earth. But they know me, see."
"Okie dokie, show me."
A light shone from the window of an hut, and swiftly they advanced towards it, passing through the walls of mud and stone. They found a cheerful company assembled around a glowing fire. An old man and woman with their children and their children's children and another generation beyond that, all decked out gaily in their holiday attire. The old man, in a voice that seldom rose above the howling of the wind in the barren wastes, was singing them a Christmas song. It had been a very old song when he was a boy, and from time to time they all joined in the chorus.
So surely as they raised their voices, the old man got quite blurry.
Don't know that word.
And loud, and so surely as it stopped, his vigour sank again. But the spirit did not tarry here, but bade Scrooge to hold his robe, and passing on above the moor, sped, well, whither? Not to sea. Eh, to sea. To Scrooge's horror, looking back, he saw the last of the land, a frightful range of rocks behind them. It's a bit like snowman's walking in the air. And his ears were deafened by the thundering of water as it rolled and roared and raged among the dreadful caverns it had worn and fiercely tried to undermine in the earth. Built upon a dismal reef of sunken rocks some leagues or so from the shore, on which the water chafed, dashed and scamped the wild years through, there stood a solitary lighthouse. Great heaps of seaweed clung to its base, and storm birds born of the wind.
We heard you say, Paul, what's up?
It's just that's the next page, and it's just solid blocks of descriptive text. It's quite hard going sometimes, Cecil. I almost wish I'd just asked to be Tiny Tim instead of the narrator. I thought it would be all playing with a rat and being omnipotent, but it's a lot of chat, Cecil.
Yeah, well, it's your choice.
Yeah, I know. Here we go. But even here, two men who watched the light made had scrolled up too far there. Sorry. But even here, two men who watched the light had made a fire, though the loophole in the thick stone wall shed out a ray of brightness on the awful sea. Joining their horny hands over the rough table at which they sat, they wished each other a Merry Christmas into their can of grog, and one of them, the elder too, with his face all damaged and scarred with hard weather, as the figurehead of an old ship might be, struck up a sturdy song that was like a gale itself. Again the ghost sped on, above the black and heaving sea, on and on and on, until, being far away, as he told Scrooge from any shore, they lighted upon a ship. They stood beside the helmsman at the wheel, the lookout at the bow, the officer who had the watch, and the dark, ghostly figures in their several stations. But every man among them hummed a Christmas tune, or had a Christmas thought, or spoke, below his breath, to his companion, of some bygone day, that bygone day being a Christmas day, with homeward hopes belonging to it. And every man on board, waking or sleeping, good or bad, had a kinder word for one another on that day than on the rest of the days of the year, and had to share some extent of their festivities, and had remembered those he'd cared for at a distance, and had known that they delighted to remember him. It was a great surprise to Scrooge, while listening to the moaning of the wind and thinking what a solemn thing it was to move on through the lonely darkness of an unknown abyss, whose depths, whose secrets were as profound as death. It was a great surprise to Scrooge, while thus engaged, to hear a hearty laugh. It was much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognise it as his own nephew's. As in, what's going on, he's thinking.
Please don't even imagine what my character's saying. I shall only be the one that does the words for him, thank you.
Fair enough. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognise it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a dry, bright, gleaming room, with the spirit standing, smiling by his side, and looking at that same nephew with approving affability. Laughed Scrooge's nephew. If you should happen, by any unlikely chance, to know a man more blessed in a laugh than Scrooge's nephew, all I can say is, I should like to know him too, introduce him to me, and I'll cultivate his acquaintance. It is a fair, even-handed, noble adjustment of things, that while there is infection in disease and sorrow, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humour. COVID-19, maybe. When Scrooge's nephew laughed in this way, Holding his sides, rolling his head and twisting his face into the most extravagant contortions, Scrooge's niece, by marriage of course, laughed as heartily as he did, and their assembled friends began not a bit behindhand. Didn't know that was a word. And they roared out lustily.
"He said that Christmas was a humbug, as I live,"
cried Scrooge's nephew.
"He believed it too."
"Oh, that's more a shame for him, Fred," said Scrooge's niece indignantly.
"Bless those women, they never do anything by halves. They're always in earnest. Oof, dear me. She was very pretty, exceedingly pretty, with a dimpled, surprised look, a capital face, a ripe little mouth that seemed to be made to be kissed, as it no doubt was. Oh, my goodness, it's gone a bit bawdy, everybody."
"Skip this bit, Paul, it's filthy."
"No, it's culture, Mum, we can't skip it."
"Bloody hell."
All kinds of good little dots about her chin that melted into one another when she laughed, and the sunniest pair of eyes you ever saw in any little creature's head. Although she was not what you would have called provoking, i.e. she's thick, you know, but satisfactorily, she's all right. Perfectly satisfactory.
"He's a comical old fellow, I tell you,"
said Scrooge's nephew.
That's the truth. And not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offences carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him."
"Oh, I'm sure he's very rich, Fred," hinted Scrooge's niece. "At least, you always tell me so."
"Yeah, well, what of that, my dear?"
said Scrooge's nephew.
"His wealth is of no use to him. He doesn't do any good with it. He doesn't make himself comfortable with it. He hasn't the satisfaction of thinking... that he's ever going to benefit us with it."
"I've no patience with him,"
observed Scrooge's niece. Scrooge's niece's sisters and all the other ladies expressed the same opinion.
"Oh, I have it,"
said Scrooge's nephew.
"I'm sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by all his ill whims? Himself. Always himself. Here he takes it to its head to dislike us. Well, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequences? It don't lose me much dinner. Should I be doing this Cockney, Paul?"
Maybe. Maybe try it Cockney, Tony."
All right, then. "Oh, I'm sorry for him."
"That's no different, Tony."
"Oh, call blind me trousers. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by his ill whims? Hey, himself. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come to dinner with us. What's the consequence? He don't lose much of a dinner."
"No, knock that on the head, Tony. That was awful."
"Yeah, I'm just reading the text."
"Yeah.
Indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner, actually," interrupted Scrooge's niece.
Everyone else said the same, and they must be allowed to have been... They must have been competent judges, because they had just had the dinner with the dessert upon the table. They were clustered around the fire by lamplight.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it,"
said Scrooge's nephew,
"because I haven't had great faith in these young housekeepers. What do you say, Topper?"
Topper, whoever that is, had clearly got his eye upon one of Scrooge's niece's sisters, for he answered that a bachelor was a wretched outcast, who had no right to express an opinion on the subject, whereas Scrooge's niece's sisters, the plump one with the lace tucker, not the one with the roses, blushed.
"Go on, Fred,"
said Scrooge's nieces, clasping her hands.
"He never finishes what he begins to say. He's such a ridiculous fellow."
Scrooge's nephew revelled in another laugh, and it was impossible to keep the infection off, though the plump sister tried hard to do it with aromatic vinegar. His example was unanimously followed. "Are you ready, Tony?"
"Yep. I was only going to say,"
Scrooge's nephew said, go on, Tony."
"Yeah, I don't need prompting, I can read."
"Sorry," Scrooge's nephew said,
"that the consequence of him taking a dislike to us and not making merry with us is, I think, that he loses some pleasant moments. which could do him no harm. I'm sure he loses pleasanter companions than he can find in his own thoughts, either in his mouldy old offices or his dusty chambers. I mean, to give him the same chance every year, whether he likes it or not, I pity for him. He may rail at Christmas until he dies, but he can't keep tripped over it, Paul.
Yeah, it's all right. Just slow down a little bit. You're just getting a little ahead of yourself.
Sorry. He may rail at Christmas till he dies. I've lost where I am, Paul. Help me.
You're there.
If he finds me going there, what? It's all gone wrong, Paul.
Yeah, now, I knew this would happen. You see, you've seen that big wall of text and you've got yourself overfaced, haven't you? Just take one sentence at a time. Okay, you calm? Yeah? Do you want to go from the top or just from there?
Come here.
All right, okay.
Yeah. He may rail at Christmas till he dies, but he can't help thinking better of it. What? I defy him. If he finds me going there in good temper year after year and saying, Uncle Scrooge, how are you? If he only puts him in the vein to leave us his poor clerk £50, that's something. And I shook him yesterday.
Awful. Really bad.
Yeah.
It was their turn to laugh now at the notion of him shaking Scrooge. But being thoroughly good-natured and not much caring at what they laughed at, so that they laughed at any rate, he encouraged them in their merriment and passed the bottle joyously. God, here we go, more texts. After tea, they had some music, for they were a musical family, and they knew what they were about. When they sung such a glee or catch, I can assure you, especially Topper, who could growl away the bass like any good one could have done, and never swell the large veins in his forehead or get red in the face over it, Scrooge's niece played well upon the harp and played among the other tunes a simple little air. A mere nothing. You might learn to whistle in a minute or two. Which had been familiar to the child who had fetched Scrooge from the boarding school, as he had been reminded by the ghost of Christmas past. Whatever. When this strain of music sounded, all the things that the ghost had shown him came upon his mind. He softened more and more. And thought of that if he could have listened to it often, years ago, he might have cultivated the kindness of his life and of his own happiness, with his own hearts, without resorting to the sexton's spade that buried Jacob Marley? Don't know. Did very bad at school. But they didn't devote the whole evening to music. After a while, they played at forfeits. For it's good for children. It's good to be children for sometimes. I wonder if that's like Truth or Dare, but Dickensian, Victorian, whatever it is.
Yeah, probably, Paul.
For it's good to be children sometimes, and never better at Christmas, when its mighty founder was a child himself. Stop! There was at first a game of blind man's buffs. Of course there was. And no more believe Topper was really blind than believe he had eyes in his boots. My opinion is that it was the done thing between him and Scrooge's nephew that the ghost of Christmas present knew it. What on earth? Because the way he went after that plump sister in the lace tucker was an outrage on the credulity of human nature. Got a bit handsy, I think, basically, is what they're getting at. Knocking down fire irons, tumbling over the chairs, bumping against pianos, smothering himself amongst the curtains. Wherever she went, there he went, the saucy little bastard. He always knew where the plump sister was, maybe she sank. He wouldn't catch anybody else, and if you'd fallen up against him, as some of them did on purpose, he would have made a faint endeavour to try and seize you, which you would have been affronted in your understanding, and he got her off in the corner and rutted her really out.
Sorry. Dirty boy.
Scrooge's niece was not one of the blind man's buff's party, but was made comfortable with a large chair and a footstool in a snug corner where the ghost and Scrooge were close behind her. But she joined in the forfeits and loved her love to admiration with all the letters of the alphabet. Likewise, the game of how, when, and where was very great, and to see the secret joy of Scrooge's nephew beat her sister's hollow. Though they were sharp girls too, as Topper could have told you, there might have been 20 people there, young and old, but they all played, and so did Scrooge, for wholly forgetting the interest he had in what was going on, that his voice made no sound to their ears, he sometimes came out with his guesses quite loudly, and often guessed quite right too. But for the sharpest needle, best Whitechapel, warranted not to cut his cut in the eye? What was not sharper than Scrooge, blunt as he looked in his head to be? We'll get to some speech soon. The ghost was greatly pleased to find him in the mood, and looked upon him with such favour that he begged, like a boy, to be allowed to stay until the guests departed. But this spirit said he could not be done.
"Here's a new game," said Scrooge. "One half-hour spirit, only one."
This was a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something, and the rest must find out what. He only answered to their question, yes or no. The brisk fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited from him that he was thinking of an animal, a live animal, a rather disagreeable animal, a savage animal, an animal that growled and grunted sometimes, and talked sometimes, and lived in London, and walked about the streets, and wasn't made a show of, and wasn't led by anybody, and didn't live in a menagerie, was never killed in a market, and was not a horse, an ass, a cow, a bull, a tiger, a dog, a pig, a cat, or even a bear. At every fresh question that was put to him, this nephew burst into a fresh row of laughter, and it was so inexpressibly tickled that he was obliged to get up off the sofa and stamp. At last the plump sister, falling into a similar state, cried out, "Someone?
I found it. I know what it is, Fred. I think I know what it is."
"What is it, then?"
said Fred.
It's your Uncle Scrooge,"
said the plump girl. Which it certainly was. Admiration was a universal sentiment, though some objected to the reply that "it is a bear" ought to have been yes, inasmuch as an answer in the negative as it was sufficient to have diverted their thoughts from Mr. Scrooge, supposing they had ever had any tendency that way.
"It's given us plenty of merriment, I am sure,"
said Fred,
"and it would be ungrateful not to drink to his health. Here's a glass of mulled wine ready for our hand at the merriment. And I say, Uncle Scrooge."
"Well done, Uncle Scrooge," everyone applied, cried in unison.
"A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to the old man, whatever he is,"
said Scrooge's nephew.
"He wouldn't take it from me, but he may have it nonetheless. Uncle Scrooge."
Uncle Scrooge had imperceptibly become so gay and light of the heart, he would have pledged the unconscious company in return and thanked them in an inaudible speech if the ghost had given him time. But the whole scene passed off in the breath of the last word spoken by the nephew, and he and the spirit were once again on their travels. Much they saw and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy ending. The spirit stood beside the sick beds, and they were cheerful, and on foreign lands and close at home lands, by struggling men, and were patient in their great hope. What? By poverty and in an almshouse, whatever that is, hospital, a jail, in misery's every refuge, where in vain man in his little brief authority had not made fast the door and barred the spirit out, he left his blessing and taught Scrooge his precipitates, whatever that means. Learning a lot. We're not learning, we're just confused by a lot, aren't we, Cecil? It was a long night, if it were only a night. But Scrooge had his doubts about this, because the Christmas holidays appeared to be condensed into the space of time that they passed together. It was strange, too, that while Scrooge remained unaltered by his outward form, the ghost grew older, clearly older. Scrooge had observed this change, but never spoken of it, until they left a children's Twelfth Night party. When looking at the spirit as they stood together in an open place, he noticed that the hair on the spirit's head was grey.
"Are spirits' lives so short?"
asked Scrooge.
"Ooh, my life upon this globe is so very brief,"
replied the ghost.
"It ends at tonight."
Tonight?
Cried Scrooge.
"Yes, tonight.
Ooh, at midnight. Hark, even. The time draws near.
The chimes were ringing in 11:15 at that very moment.
Forgive me if I'm not justified in what I ask,
said Scrooge, looking intently at the spirit's robe.
But I see something strange and not belonging to yourself, protruding from your skirts. Is it a foot or a claw? Ooh, it might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it,
was the spirit's sorrowful reply.
Ooh, look here.
From the foldings of its robe it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable bastards. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment.
Ooh, Moo, look, look down here,
exclaimed the ghost. There were a boy and girl, yellow, meagre, ragged, scowling, and wolfish, but prostrate, two in their humility. While graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shrivelled hand, like that of age, had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacingly. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity, in any grade, through all the mysteries of wonderful creation, had monsters half so horrible and dread, spooky. Scrooge stared back appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves. Rather than be parties to a lie in such an enormous magnitude.
Spirit, are they yours?
Said Scrooge.
No, they are man's.
Excuse me, said the spirit, looking down upon them.
And they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy's ignorance. Ooh. The girl is want. Ooh. Beware them both and all their degree. But most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that is written is doom. Unless the writing be erased, deny it,
cried the spirit, stretching out its hands towards the city.
Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it to for your physician's purpose, and make it worse, and abide the end. Have they no refuge or resource?
Cried Scrooge.
Ooh, are they no prisons?
Said the spirit, turning to him for the last time with his own words.
Ooh. Are there no workhouses?
The bell struck 12. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost and saw it not. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley. Lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground. Crawling towards him. Shit. The Radio Thax Players presents Dickens' Christmas Carol, narrated by Paul Thax, voices by Sir Jeremy Crean, Cecil Thax, Margaret Thax, Beryl Horrible, Tony Monondestry, who else? Eugene Pent. And various others, maybe. But I don't think so. I think that's it. Thank you.